Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we sent out this past year 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org and check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. One of our favorite all-time guests. We go back a lot of years. Five-time winner of the Boston Marathon, three-time winner of the L.A. Marathon, one of the top wheelchair racers of all time. Mr. Jim Knobb joins us from his palatial estate up in Long Beach, California. How you doing, Jimmy?
Yeah. My palatial estate with a $7 card table I got at Salvation Army. That's my dining room table.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Recycling is good for the environment.
It's good. You're right. Yeah, I'm doing great. How about you?
I am spectacular. And as I mentioned, we go back a lot of years. And for you, let's go back to pole vaulting. What was it that got you into pole vaulting originally? Were you into other sports before that?
You know, just minor stuff. You know, when I was born, I was, you know, premature baby and exposed. I had tuberculosis and lots of problems and was in an incubator for a long time. And so, you know, I was late to any kind of sports. You know, I tried to play football, but just continually got run over. I didn't know you were supposed to block. I just thought you were supposed to stand there. So the thing that attracted me to pole vaulting was that it was more of a solo effort. It wasn't relying on a team of people. And my brother was a pole vaulter in high school. So, and I had started in gymnastics as a fourth grader and really enjoyed running. And you put those two things together, and that's pole vaulting.
It really is. And back then, we're talking, what, bamboo poles, metal poles? What were you guys using?
No, it was fiberglass.
Oh, you're fiberglass. Okay.
Yeah, it started early 70s. So, you know, fiberglass was used widely. You know, nobody was using bamboo or aluminum
anymore.
Actually, the guy that really started that movement, a guy named Hans Lagerqvist from Sweden, passed away recently. And tough deal, because he was just a great friend to all the vaulters. And yeah, so that was Hans Lagerqvist.
I remember I was interviewing Bob Segrin once, and he told me that, you know, there was a pole vaulting pole that somebody had in their garage, and they had no idea it was a sport. So they would just take this thing out in the neighborhood, and they'd, like, go from your roof to Jimmy's car to somebody else's garage and see if they can go around the block using this pole thing before he even found out that it was a sport. When you were did you compete in high school and in college pole vaulting?
I did. I went to Long Beach State, went to El Camino Junior College, and yeah.
And you were looking for Olympic trials at that point?
That was my whole deal since high school. That's all I wanted to do, you know, is to make the Olympic trials. It's just a dream.
And what was your PR in terms of height?
17.2. I jumped 17.2. I jumped 17.7 a couple times in all-comer meets, but officially 17.2.
And what did you feel you needed to do to potentially make the team?
Oh, yeah, that was going to be just impossible, you know, because when I started vaulting, you know, I had an old-time coach, and the school wouldn't even buy me a pole. I had to save up my money and get my first pole. And he said, well, you want to get one, you know, it's a little bit too big for you so you can grow into it. And I'm like, well, okay. So I got this thing, and my technique really started more like straight poling, like the old pole vaulters did, because I couldn't bend this pole. So that really held me back, a really low hand grip and, you know, that the technique that I had learned early on, you know, so that held me up in my technique, and there was no way I was even going to be an 18-footer, you know.
Right.
And you and I now know that, you know, I was never supposed to really be a pole vaulter anyway, so.
I mean, so the reality is you're going to practice one day, you're on your motorcycle. I think you were driving a route that you'd never driven before.
Yeah, that's right.
And take me through it. So you get hit and you go down, and it sounds like you knew from the time you hit the ground that there was a purpose here and there was a meaning to why this happened.
No, it was actually 6 months before the accident. I felt this. I don't even know how to describe it. There's just something weird. I kept saying, now what is that? You know, what this feeling that I had, you know, and then periodically would, you know, come upon me, as they say. And then like a month out, I kept going, what is that? What is that thing? You know? And then even the day that it happened, this sensation got even stronger. Like, something's going on. What's going on? And so I was sitting at this stoplight on a motorcycle, and old guy in front of me, turning onto my street that I was on, confused the gas for the brake and, you know, hit me and pushed me out of the car behind me. And, you know, I'm laying on the ground. The helmet was twisted sideways on my head. You know, I was on a motorcycle and the helmet was twisted sideways on my head. So I thought, this is what it's like to be dead, because I was just looking into darkness. I didn't know.
Wow.
And the woman that was behind me in her car got out and pulled the helmet off my head and, you know, slowly came to understand, I guess I'm not walking, you know. But that's when that feeling went away, and I said to myself, okay, this is what it was, you know.
This is sort of meant to be. This is what my lot in life is supposed to be.
This is where I'm supposed to be. I don't know why, you know. That's the way it was, and that's the way it's always been, you know.
So you didn't go through, because obviously a lot of people have injuries like that, and they go through, why me? They go through that depression, you know, spiraling depression, not knowing what their life is going to be like. All of a sudden, you know, I was 6 feet tall, and now I'm 3'5", and my whole life is, you know, belt buckles and and butts.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you didn't go through that, or did you?
No, not really. I think it was this sensation of, this is where I'm supposed to be, and now what's ahead of me, you know? My dad was in a wheelchair for a long time, injured in the war, and dealt with disability his whole life. So it gave me a unique perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's, especially as somebody who was athletic back then, what options were there for somebody to be an athlete who was in a wheelchair?
You know, there was basketball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stuff like that. And there was some racing. They had just started racing, you know, road racing, but not a lot. And it was mostly basketball players that were, you know, trying to stay in shape for the basketball season. It wasn't really serious, and it wasn't aligned with running at all. You know, although there were people competing in the Boston Marathon, there wasn't an official division.
Right.
You know, and I remember I did my rehab at Rancho Los Amigos Hospital in Downey, and I was watching the New York City Marathon. It was in November, and I looked up, and the lead runners were running along. And, right, Bob, how much can you say about the, well, they're running, and one guy's running a little faster. You don't say a whole lot, right?
And the hard part is, when you see a group of guys all running 4:30 pace, it could be 8-minute pace. When everybody's together, It's not really compelling television, unless you're using, you know, using a special angle with the camera. But a head-on angle, you can't, unless they're passing me, you can't tell they're going fast.
It's like bowling. You know, bowling is pretty boring until you pick up the ball and try to knock down all those pins, right?
Right.
But anyway, these runners ran past two people in wheelchairs, you know, in the race.
Yeah.
And I said, what the hell is that? And why didn't the announcers say anything about that, you know? So that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do. I started asking about racing and got a magazine that was published at the time, and you know, about wheelchair sports, and I was off and running, so to speak.
So when you started going to local road races up in LA or even down here in San Diego, were the race directors open to having you there? Because I sort of remember, you know, races were like, okay, we got $1,000 for first person across the line. And Jim Knob's like, hey, I was first across the line. Where's my freaking check?
Now, you know, I, yeah, exactly. You know, I started with some 10Ks.
Yeah.
And the race directors was fine as long as I had my $12, you know, for my entry fee.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's fine, you know. But most of the time, my first few races, I get sent the wrong way because people didn't know that I was in the race. And I'm going, which way? And they go, that way, you know, like I was trying to get on the freeway or something.
Well, and you were way ahead of the runners.
Yeah. So, and, you know, that's what it evolved to. Yeah, so the race directors are fine until it started coming to prize money. I remember I think it was the first LA Marathon, finished like at the Rose Bowl or something. I mean, way before.
Right, before it was called the LA Marathon. Yeah.
Yeah, I got second place, and the second place runner was so pissed off that I got the trophy. And I was sitting, you know, in the Rose Bowl. I had my old distance coach from high school was with me, and we're all just sitting there. And it's at the end of the award ceremony. This runner actually came running up, picked up the trophy, and ran off with it.
He stole the trophy from you.
Yeah.
I love that. So, yeah, so that wheelchair guy, he was cheating. He took my trophy. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're welcome to it. Go ahead and take it. You know, somewhere he's still got that trophy and he's proud of it.
I remember at one point, you know, we had a discussion and you mentioned something about Dwight Stones was a good friend and he was a commentator for NBC, obviously a track and field legend. And you're trying to grow wheelchair racing. You know, you're trying to create a sport and understanding that no parent wants their children to grow up to be a wheelchair racer. Right. And take me through that discussion with Dwight and what that led to.
Well, you know, early on, I was really frustrated because in some of these track events and the road races, you know, I'm at the starting line and the guy next to me is, you know, wearing Levi's and a Pendleton. I'm going, what? You know, so I was talking to Dwight about how do I grow this sport, you know, and he says, well, you're going to need, you know, the classic setup. The guy in the white hat and the guy in the black hat. You're going to need a good guy and a bad guy in order to get people to pay attention to it. And, you know, at the time, you know, Blanchett, I had retired later on. Blanchett was racing, and I realized this was really something that was really needed. So if you're just the guy in the white hat, nobody really pays attention. But, you know, like the guy in the White House right now, they pay attention if you're controversial and you say controversial things. So I put on the black hat and played that role.
And how'd you do that? I mean, I remember you showing up at races in the Dalmatian skin suit and you were an intimidating figure, but what type of things would you say to set up there? Because I'm a firm believer in rivalries. You know, over the years, our sports from running and triathlon and cycling were sort of minor sports, and your major league sports commentators, they don't, and your local news people, they don't understand. They understand baseball, football, basketball, maybe hockey.
Correct.
But
Correct.
To understand our sport, they're not going to do that for one race a year or two races a year. But they do understand rivalries. They understand two people who want the same prize and want to kick the other guy's ass.
That's right. That's why boxing is so popular, you know. And it's the way I decided to grow the sport on my end.
Yeah.
With the media. And, you know, I had some basic problems with a lot of guys that were racing anyway because they weren't athletes before, you know. And so they didn't approach it with an athletic mindset. And, you know, early on I'd have a few people that, you know, would come train with me, like Bob Hall flew out from Boston and stayed with me for a while. But they just couldn't hang. They couldn't handle it, you know, because it takes a certain athletic mindset to be able to, you know, to do what we did back then. And so, yeah, I had some problems with some people early on, and the media sort of liked that.
Of course.
Back then they didn't have anybody, you know, after a race, if you stuck a microphone in their face, they really didn't have anything to say. So
you did.
You know, yeah, I did. I enjoyed it.
Well, and I remember when we first connected, what drew me and my partner Lois, our photographer, to you guys, to wheelchair athletes, was because your stories were so rich. It wasn't just about, hey, I ran fast. It was, I give every trophy to a wheelchair kid because I want them to know that there's hope and there's future. And I remember being at your house, and there was a nickel on the ground. And I'm like going, oh my God, the, you know, poor Jim, he dropped a nickel, he can't pick it up, he's in a wheelchair. And as I'm struggling to pick up this glued to the ground nickel, you're sitting there with a beer laughing, going, Babbitt, what, you think the poor cripple couldn't pick up the nickel?
It's funny. I got that from my brother. My brother was a fireman in Long Beach for 25 years.
Yeah.
And they had to go upstairs to get up to the firehouse upstairs. And so somebody had silver soldered a, you know, a metal rod to the back of a quarter and drilled a hole and glued it down to the concrete at the bottom of the stairs. And they all used to sit there and watch how many people would walk by and kick that quarter.
Right.
See if they could, you know, and everybody would laugh. So that's why I did that.
That's,
you know?
So cool. So when you go to Boston, and back then the chairs were one step ahead of a shopping cart, maybe. I mean, they were four-wheel, they were very tippy, and even though it was a horrific accident, you guys coming down Boston, the first 6 miles are screaming downhill, you guys had this horrific crash that I think ended up everywhere, right? It was one of the greatest pieces of video of all time, because you guys are going, what, 45, 50 miles an hour down a hill, and it was like Demolition Derby.
Yeah, I was experimenting with a new chair with kind of a new geometry on the front end, and it had rained that morning and it was kind of wet, so I got over into, you know, some bad pavement, and the front end just got loose and I went over, and then the whole pack went over. And, you know, but what they don't talk about, Bob, is the same thing happened with the runners that year.
They went down too?
The lieutenant governor, who was going to, you know, fire the starting gun, didn't wait for them to take down the rope.
Oh, my God.
He fired the gun, and here's, you know, 150,000 runners behind the elite runners, and everybody started taking off, you know. They tripped over the rope.
Oh, yeah. That is funny. When you look back at those races, because in Boston, you became a big star in Boston, winning that race five times. And was Boston the main race in terms of celebrating wheelchair athletes?
Oh, I think so. I mean, they were really the first. And when you look at the depth of history of that race, and Bob Hall, who really started it all, and the runner's affections for Bob, especially Bill Rogers, and the BAA really looked for equality in our sport, and that helped other road races do the same thing. Yeah, so it's the grandfather, you know.
Yeah, and you knew that course like the back of your hand, but you also, wouldn't you go out and pre-drive it, because the pavement changes every single year because you're dealing with winters and everything?
Yeah, the pavement is scary. And there was a guy, Bob Rosenberg, who approached me one year at Boston, and we got to be friends. He used to go to Falmouth and a few other road races, and I'd be wheeling along, and all of a sudden he'd come up on his bike. But he offered, you know, to drive the course with me. So we would go out two nights before and then just the night before, and I had a fluorescent spray can, paint a can of paint, and we would drive the course, and I would mark all of the rough places to avoid with a spray paint line on the ground. So when I'm going down, you know, a 30-mile-an-hour hill, I can see that line and know to avoid it. I did the same thing at the train tracks, which were really dangerous for wheelchairs. So we'd actually get out of the car and go down there and find the best place to cross, and I would paint that up so I knew where to cross.
Love that. What was your best race there in terms of having somebody competitive with you until towards the end?
Well, you know, every year that I won, Bob, there really wasn't anybody around.
You pretty much dominated.
Yeah. And I got smart. I turned to page 14 of the Sergei Bubka handbook, and later years I would actually be on the brakes a little bit, trying to just break the record by a little bit, because I knew I'd want to come back the next year.
Exactly.
There was a bonus for breaking the record.
Yeah, I don't get that when people break records by 4 or 5 minutes. I'm like, no, Sergey, one-tenth of a second. What are you thinking?
That's right.
I love it.
That's right.
So
yeah.
You mentioned Craig Blanchett. Craig Blanchett, double above knee amputee from birth. And you guys had some battles. There was a rivalry there. He was the first Nike Just Do It athlete. Could you guys beef? Did you guys have discussions saying, hey, black hat, white hat, to grow the sport, we need to, you know, we can't be buddies. We have to sort of hate each other and do a little WWE here?
No, we never discussed it. I was actually retired from racing.
I know.
And Craig came out and said a couple of things that I didn't like in the media.
Like what? What did he say?
Just personal things, and I didn't like it.
Oh.
So I decided, well, you know, I guess I got to come back out of retirement.
Put that back. Put that black hat back on.
Yeah. So and the thing about Craig is his approach was always, in my view, Bob.
Yeah.
His approach was always about Craig. You know. Yeah, he did a lot to bring some light to the sport, but he didn't water it and help it grow, and that's why it is where it is today, you know?
It really, when hand cycling came in, the wheelchair side of it, because during that era with yourself and, Blanchette and Bob Kennedy, not Bob Kennedy, but it was another Kennedy.
Doug Kennedy.
Yep, there was a lot of really good guys. And when one of the things that always hit me with the wheelchair side of it was that you would go, the racing was one thing, but I'd heard it from so many different folks who were in rehab. And Bruce Cornell told me this story, and I've heard it over and over again, that they would be in rehab and the people would be telling them, you need to get a van with a lift. You can't do this, you can't do that. And meanwhile, he's looking out the window and you're rolling up in a 62 Rambler convertible and, you know, sort of tossing your chair out of the back of the car and diving into the chair and rolling into the rehab center and telling everybody, listen, they've told you what you can't do. I'm here to tell you what you can do. How important was that aspect of your life?
Well, it was really important, and I'll tell you where that grew from. I made the U.S. team to go to the Pan Am Games up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and at the time, the guy was Rick Hansen.
You know, oh, yeah.
He was the stud, and he proceeded to kick my ass at every event. And afterwards, we were talking, and I was talking about winning, and I just want to win, and he told me something really important. He said, it's not just winning. It's what you do with that win.
Yes.
That makes it worthwhile, you know, and that's Rick Hansen. That's why he is who he is. And that stuck with me forever. And so I made it a point to do something, you know, with my victories and with my success. And that's just a byproduct of winning.
The other thing you saw was David Bailey, motocross champion, making $750,000 a year, paralyzed in an accident while he was out on his motorcycle, and he was very resistant to getting into wheelchair racing. But I think you saw the vision that this guy with his notoriety could bring a ton of attention to our sport.
Yeah, you know, somebody had called me and said, hey, we got a guy, can you help him out? You know, I get those phone calls periodically.
Yep.
And I really didn't know, really didn't care who David Bailey was. There was this guy, and he's in a wheelchair, and, you know, okay.
Right.
It didn't, I mean, okay, yeah, it's impressive. He was the great motocross racer and all that, but it just, none of that really mattered to me, you know? After a while, he decided to give it a shot, and we got him in a racing chair. And that's when I realized, you know, there's a different way than just putting on a black hat and a white hat. You can actually have somebody and other people in the sport that can compete like an athlete instead
right.
of, you know, a guy in Levi's and a Pendleton.
Right. Well, and he was a world-class athlete before and was known as the smoothest guy in motocross. So he was going to be a quick study once he got into it. In terms of
he'd been training for a triathlon, so he
yes.
had the base to really know what to do when it came to wheelchair racing, you know.
When you started working with him at JT Sunglasses, and maybe it was at No Fear, I can't remember which, but you when did you get the sense that David was going to embrace this? Because yeah, I remember him saying when Jimmy was like, hey, this could be more important to you than motocross ever was. And he's like, yeah, you don't understand.
Yeah. And I probably still get that today from him, but,
yeah.
Early on, I realized that he had some potential, you know, especially just the drive and determination to excel in this sport. And, you know, disabled sports, it's a strange animal. It's like an addictive drug, because people with disabilities really kind of use this to justify their existence and compete to prove that they're not disabled, you know, especially early on in the early years.
Right.
So, you know, you can see when somebody gets the fire and, you know, really makes the sacrifices and trains hard to really do something, because they're chasing that drug, you know.
So when you started traveling with Ben, Bailey talks about it. So listen, we went to, Jimmy was like, let's go to Australia and deep sea fishing and parachuting and doing all sorts of, basically living. Did you see a light switch go on with him?
Well, you know, the first time, I always described David as the $6 million man. Do you remember that? When every transfer that Dave would do, everything that he did was like slow motion like that. And I'm like, man, what are you doing? He never went through traditional rehab, so he never learned just the basic skills.
Well, because his whole mentality was, I'll be out of this chair.
Yeah, I'll be walking pretty soon.
You know?
So I said, I'll tell you what, let's take a weekend. We'll go to Cabo and we'll do a clinic. We'll teach you all the transfers. We'll teach you how to do stuff and, you know, give you some skills so that you can just deal with life, you know, before you start walking again. And so we did that. We went down there, and I remember showing up at LAX to meet him for the flight, and his wife is standing there with a portable commode. And I'm going, David, what are you doing, man? On the travel with a portable commode. I said, no, you don't need that. So we got all that fixed and squared away, and he really learned a lot, I think, on that trip. So we started traveling a little bit more. We went to Australia and a few other races, and it was great that he got to be around other people with disabilities and other athletes and learned a lot from them as well, you know.
So some of my favorite sound bites from 40 years of doing this stuff come from Jim Knopp. Why walk when you can fly was one that Bailey told me, right? That when he was talking about, gosh, I've got to use a lift. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. How do I pee? Talk a little bit about, you know, what led to that and what led to why walk when you can fly.
You know, I think it was the second or third time that we had hung out a little bit. I was down at JT and we were going somewhere and we were in his van, and he was just pissing and moaning about not being able to walk and do all the other things. And it just kind of came off the top of my head. I said, David, why do you worry so much about walking again when you're going to be able to fly, you know? And metaphorically speaking,
sure.
Of course, you know,
in
life, when you deal and learn from this disability, it can bring a richness and a full life if you approach it the right way and kind of embrace the lessons.
As you watched him head towards Kona and the Ironman, did that surprise you?
No, I mean, we'd actually trained in Kona before, and I remember, you know, driving the course, and shit, I was tired from driving the course. I'm like, this is ridiculous, David, you're not going to do this, you know? but you know, it's what he wanted to do. And that's just a tribute to him. I mean, I remember driving out there and driving down the highway, so windy. I'm going, how in the world?
Yeah.
But he did it, you know, and, you know, good for him. Right. I mean, he eventually embraced the disability and learned from it. And, it motivated him to want to do more. And so I hope that came true for him, that this is now more important than motocross was, or maybe just even different, you know?
Right. Well, and what was cool is you talked about black hat, white hat, and rivalries, that rivalry that developed between the Navy SEAL, Carlos Maleda, who was paralyzed when he was shot in the back, and the motocross superstar in 98, 99, 2000, really was on par with the Dave Scott, Mark Allen, Aaron Baker, Paul Nibby Frazier. It was two guys who wanted the same prize, and they would kill each other to do it. And that was two guys in wheelchairs, and the disability disappeared. It didn't matter.
Exactly. In the presence of that kind of a rivalry, disability or how it happened or what, none of that's important. You know, you're just out there trying to kick the other guy's ass.
What was the best race you ever had?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, I've had some great races. One time I did, I'll tell you kind of a neat story. Oz Day 10K down in Australia was a wheelchair only race held on their Oz Day, you know, their 4th of July. And I won the first year. I went back for the second year and got a gigantic lead. Before this, there was I'd met a little girl a year before when I was down there, and a disabled girl. And mm-hmm. I made her a racing chair. I was working for a company in Fresno at the time. We made her a racing chair and I surprised her with it and helped her make some gloves and everything. And she decided to enter this race. And I said, well, it's a little soon, you know, you kind of just got started, but she was determined. And so, you know, we both showed up to the race and, that year I got off to a big start and, you know, their 4th of July, I think people tend to drink a little bit and it's right. You pass under that coat hanger bridge where people were throwing beer bottles off the bridge and I got a flat tire. It's a double loop course. And on the way out, I got a flat tire and I thought, oh man, now I can't finish. I got a flat. And I said, you know what? No, I'm going to keep going. So I kept going and still had this lead with a flat tire and made the turnaround and coming back the other way. And I got a second flat tire. I go, that's it. I got to quit. And I looked up and there's Holly, this little girl in a racing chair on her first lap. And I said, there's no way I can't finish this race now, you know, and it was a really hard uphill with some cobblestones at the end and doing this on two flat tires was just ridiculous. And anyway, I did it and I won. And, you know, I kind of owe that to her, you know.
Right.
It's a funny story because the year before, Bailey had some helmets done by Troy Lee for us to go down to do this race. And they were really nice American Eagles on there and the flag and the whole thing. And I finished the race. And afterwards, when I met this girl, Holly, we're wheeling back and I see this little girl off on the sideline and I took my helmet off and gave it to her. And I thought David was going to fall out of his chair. He goes, what are you doing? You can't do that. That's a Troy Lee helmet, you know? And that's when Holly and I became friends and decided to make her a chair.
That is so cool. So yeah. The other quote was in the MTV sports piece where you said something that really resonated. It didn't matter if you were able-bodied athlete or if you were a challenged athlete. It's, you know, the winner of the race isn't the person who goes the fastest. It's the person who slows down the least.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a Carl Lewis quote, actually.
Is it?
Carl Lewis said in the 100 meters, it's not necessarily the person that's the fastest. It's the one that slows down the least at the end. Because at the end, that's when your form falls apart. And you tighten up and, you know, so he says, really, it's the one that slows down the least. And I listened to that and I said, you know, that really pertains to wheelchair racing.
No question.
You know, and life, really, you know.
When you look back at how much the chairs have changed in terms of racing chairs, have they changed that much?
Well, no, because sports kind of died out a little bit.
Yep.
And there's nobody who races that's really pushing the design. You know, BMW, I guess, came out with a carbon fiber chair.
For Alex Zanardi in terms of a hand cycle and a racing chair,
And it came out for the Olympics and everything. But, you know, that really hasn't offered a lot of performance to the sport. The designs haven't been pushed that much, really. You know, basically you look at the chair that I won Boston with, you know, half a century ago, it seems. And you look at the chairs now and they're basically the same.
How much did hand cycling impact racing chairs and just the whole concept of, you know, people get into hand cycling and it seems like the racing chair has fallen off in terms of awareness, in terms of racing?
Yeah, you know, racing in a chair is really tough, Bob.
It is.
Not only, you know, now you can just go buy a racing chair, but back in the day, we had to make everything. We had to make our own gloves and maintain all that. And the position is hard to get the right position, and it's uncomfortable. And
yeah,
it just doesn't really fit. Hand cycling, you can just jump in a hand cycle and put your beer in the cup holder and off you go, you know?
Exactly.
So, yeah, it impacted it because it's easier to get into, and it has a recreational side. Well, wheelchair racing doesn't have a recreational side. And
that's a really good point. Yeah, you can't. You're not just going to go out with the family and ride around the lake on your racing chair.
Yeah, exactly. You know, So, and hand cycling is great, and it's taken off, and they have their own races.
Yep.
You know, I think that hand cycling has negatively impacted wheelchair sports in a way, in that a while ago there was a kook that was going around and suing all the marathons because he wanted to be in the division,
right,
and collect the prize money. And then so race directors started saying, well, then we're not going to have a division, you know.
Right.
So
yeah,
so you know, it's give and take, right?
So we have an American now, Daniel Romanchuk, who's won everything when it comes to racing chairs, right? He's in the last year, he won, you know, Chicago and New York and Boston and London, and then, you know, those same races again. Have you followed him at all, and what are your thoughts on him?
Well, I followed his racing career. I've never met him and haven't listened to too many interviews. I think it's great that he's winning everything, Bob, but as long as he does something with it.
Exactly.
You know?
Platform. You've got a platform to speak from. To get new
That's
people
right.
in. Yeah, I've interviewed right. Daniel a few times, and he gets it, right? He understands that he is sort of a spokesperson for the sport. And
That's good.
He works with kids to get them out there. And, when you were training seriously as a top-level athlete, take me through what type of things you were doing besides just spending time on the chair.
Well, you know, early on... I didn't have anybody to train with, really. So, you know, I remember one time when I was able-bodied, I rode my bike to Huntington Beach Pier and back. And I thought with racing, I go, well, maybe if I just strive just to do that in my racing chair. You know, so that became the route. You know, we had two. That was the 24-miler, which was Huntington Beach Pier and back. And the other one was a 16-miler, which was more inland. So I used to basically just wheel to Huntington Beach Pier and back every day, you know, as kooky as that was in all the traffic. I wouldn't do it today, but that's how I started, you know, just kind of retracing my footsteps, so to speak.
Yeah.
When I was able-bodied, you know.
Did you do much weight training?
Yeah, I did. I'd lifted, obviously, as a pole vaulter.
Yeah.
And I knew that upper body strength was going to be, you know, paramount to winning some races. So, yeah, I trained over here in Long Beach at the Belmont just about every night, you know, lifting. So,
and yeah. Do you train much now, or is that all sort of in the past?
Bob, I just sort of hope I can get out of bed now, you know, in and out of the car. Those, you know, 40 years in a wheelchair, my shoulders have had it. And, you know, I'm just trying to spend every day above dirt at this point,
Love it. And when you look back at your career and, you know, you 5 Boston, 3 LAs, just sort of putting wheelchair racing on the map, would you do anything differently?
No, Bob, I don't think so. I couldn't imagine really doing it any differently. You know, everybody has regrets, and there is some things, that I would have done maybe a little different, but, for the most part, you know, it's been a kick. It was a good ride, and, the people that I met and the places that I've been, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah, and you had, there was a, at one point, I remember a pilot for a sitcom. I think it was going to be you and Tom Sullivan or something like that, the blind entertainer Tom Sullivan and Jim Knob, the wheelchair athlete.
Yeah, we actually filmed a pilot. It didn't get picked up, but...
Boy, I'd love to see the pilot. Did you ever get a copy of that?
I think I have one somewhere.
That would be fun to watch.
Yeah, what was it? I think it was called The Good Life.
You know,
or the Easy Life or something. I think Easy Life is what it was called. Not too bad. It never got picked up, you know. But then again, if it did, I really wouldn't have continued my racing career. So
there, yeah, perfect. Hey, Jimmy, always a pleasure to catch up and chat with you. I love all that you've done,
Thank you.
Inspire other athletes and get them out there and making sure they understand that, you know, there's life after tragedy. And they can move forward. And you've been, right from the very beginning, a very big supporter of what we do at Challenge Athletes Foundation.
Yep. It's amazing how far that's gone since we sat there at lunch and started talking about it, you know?
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
Good for cool. you, you know?
And it's funny because I remember when you were on the cover of Competitor in the four-wheeled chair, I think, right?
Yeah.
The Vaulter.
Yeah.
In the four-wheeled chair, and then we did that other photo shoot with you in your, was it a 56 Ford pickup?
54, my 54 Chevy pickup, yeah.
And actually, that was the other thing, is I remember you telling, I don't know if you're telling Bailey, but it's like, listen, you want an athletic event, trying to get from the driver's seat of my pickup into the chair. You know, I was pole vaulting, I got three shots to get over a height. I got one shot to get into my chair or I'm on the freaking ground.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's, that was an incredible truck. I really enjoyed building that thing. And, you know, that was a byproduct of my racing. And I used to get a bonus for winning Boston and breaking the record. And I would usually take that money and restore a classic car, hot rod that I wanted. So that truck, that was a byproduct of that.
Love it. Jimmy, thanks again for taking so much time. Always, always love chatting with you.
Thanks, Babbitt. Good to talk to you.
Jim Knob has been our guest again. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's generationucan.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation. Last year, we sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game alive through sport. To help out, go to challengeathletes.org, and you can check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and BabbittVille.com. As always, endurance lives here.